You're listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Hi, everybody, and welcome back to We Are STS. I'm your host, Professor Joe Kane. This is a bonus episode. Get ready for something special. Students are desperate for job experience. Over the summer this year, we ran a traineeship program in journalism. We called it the STS Newsroom, and wow, what a success! We worked for 8 weeks with two goals in mind. First, to create the 2021 edition of our annual newsletter, STS Alchemy. You can see that result on our website. The second task was to create podcasts. We asked students in the newsroom to decide what story they wanted to tell, go off and create the interviews, help each other solve problems they encountered, then produce the podcast as something around a 30-minute complete piece. Our podcast today is the first episode from the series. It was created by Jasmine Chakaravarti. Jasmine graduated from UCL in 2021, having done a lot of work in creative content generation. In her podcast for the STS Newsroom, Jasmine explored the idea of vaccine hesitancy. That was a growing issue over the summer, and we've seen it develop significantly, both in places around the world and also in certain economic and cultural groups. I'm just going to turn the microphone over to Jasmine. Take it away! I'll see everybody else on the other side.
I'm not sure that I want to get the vaccine, is what my flatmate told me in early December. My initial response to this was shocked anger and frustration. How could someone that was in my circle and with the same level of education as me be anti-vax? Since then, I've realised that it's not that simple. My flatmate isn't anti-vax. He was merely expressing some concerns and some doubts about a new vaccine. Over the last few months, I've come to realise that vaccine acceptance isn't as simple as I'd previously thought. It's not the simple binary between the anti-vaxxers on one end and the rest of us on the other, but a much more nuanced and complex situation. But what exactly is vaccine hesitancy? How can it be understood in the context of the COVID-19 pandemic? And how can we even begin to approach this complex issue? My name's Jasmine Chakravarti. I'm a UCL undergraduate student, and today I'm speaking to four UCL academics to better understand this topic. Professor Helen Bedford, who's a professor of children's health at the UCL Great Ormond Street Institute of Child Health, and who is a child public health researcher with a particular interest in childhood immunisation. Dr. Stephen Hughes, who is a lecturer in the STS department at UCL and whose research focuses on science communication and the interface between science and society. Dr. Catherine Wolfe, who is an associate professor of medical education at UCL and is currently working on a project called UCL Reach, which looks at the COVID-19 outcomes in healthcare workers from different ethnic backgrounds. And finally, Professor Sarah Edwards, who is a professor of bioethics in the STS department at UCL and is at the forefront of the COVID-19 well-being study, which explores the perceived coercion and psychological well-being arising from the COVID-19 pandemic in both the general population and in frontline healthcare workers. Professor Bedford, what exactly is meant by vaccine hesitancy and how does it differ from anti-vax attitudes?
Well, vaccine hesitancy is a fairly new sort of terminology, really, that's only started being used in about the last 10 years. But it's been defined by the World Health Organization as where people delay or decline vaccination, even though vaccines are available and vaccine services are available. It's interesting because it's become a term that's used very widely in mainstream media since the COVID pandemic and COVID vaccine came on the scene. We're talking about vaccine hesitancy a lot. And what the the way it's being used is really where people have doubts or concerns or questions about vaccination, which I think is a much better definition of vaccine hesitancy, because hesitancy just means I'm a bit unsure, I don't know what to do. So if you think about vaccine acceptance on a spectrum, at one end, a very, very tiny proportion of the population will be anti-vaxxers who often have quite extreme views. And then on the other end, there will be people who just go along and get vaccinated when it's offered to them. And in between, there's all different sort of levels of people who may have concerns and questions, which when answered will be quite happy. Other people may want to take longer. So it's quite an interesting spectrum to think about.
Well, we've seen in recent data that's been released that in the UK, higher vaccine hesitancy has been reported among certain demographic groups. So, for example, women tend to be more hesitant. Younger age groups tend to be more hesitant, as well as those with a lower level of education. So I'm wondering if there are any other demographic differences and where these stem from and what they might mean. Professor Bedford.
So one of the striking things is that there's a very clear difference in vaccine acceptance amongst different ethnic groups. So some ethnic groups have been much more resistant or reluctant to be vaccinated. And that comes from a number of things, because what is fundamentally important in any vaccine acceptance program is trust in the organizations that are offering the vaccine. And for some ethnic minority groups, they don't feel they've always been included in things, or they may, you know, the healthcare they get is sometimes not as optimal as it should be. So those groups have often sort of expressed, you know, I really don't trust this vaccine, don't trust the government, don't trust the health service, and that has had an impact on acceptance. But gradually, although it's not sorted by any means, we are seeing more and more people in those groups who are also at greater risk of the disease, so really, really do need the vaccine, coming on board and accepting the vaccine. But this has taken a lot of work with groups locally, by trusted leaders, by religious leaders or local community leaders. And what we need to be doing, whatever the group you're dealing with, is actually listening to what people are saying, listening to their concerns and responding appropriately, and not just expecting people to jump on board immediately.
Dr. Hughes, is it possible to pinpoint why people might be hesitant towards getting vaccinated or towards getting the COVID-19 vaccination? And also why specific groups might be particularly hesitant towards getting this vaccine?
It's a tricky one, because there are many good reasons why people feel disempowered already, feel dislocated from, you know, being part of society. They don't feel like citizens. And so any further loss of liberty, as far as they're concerned, they could, you know, they could have already lost out based on income, being poor, being transgender, being an ethnic minority, and, you know, fears of losing more agency can be a trigger for people, and can make them feel, right, then I don't want to anything to do with this. And a lot of the research that's looked at vaccine hesitancy has identified liberty and freedom as being the actual real issue that's at stake here. And that it's, and you know, typically in science communication, we've learned that it's not really about the technology or the scientific thing itself, but it's about the kind of the way of life that technology brings into being. And it's the same with vaccines, that it's typically not just the technology itself, but it's about freedom and liberty. And we saw this with the kind of the shift from, at first it was about mask wearing. That was the technology that was kind of contested. Then it was lockdown, and then it was the vaccine. Then it's the test and trace, and then it's the vaccine passport. So these are all different kind of technologies, but it's the recurring theme of kind of liberty and freedom.
Right, that makes a lot of sense. So resistance or hesitancy might not be about that specific technology itself, but more broadly about what that technology or the implementation of that technology represents on a larger scale. And actually, circling back around to you, Professor Bedford, you mentioned earlier that trust is a key determinant for vaccine uptake. And I'm wondering if there are any other determinants that we might not have mentioned that you believe are essential or are noteworthy.
Well, yes. So trust is absolutely fundamental. And just taking a sidestep for a little minute, it's quite interesting if you look at vaccine hesitancy globally, because there's a strong association between whether you trust in the government and trust in uptake of vaccination. So in countries where, you know, there is less trust, they have more vaccine hesitancy, which is fascinating. But there are other important determinants to vaccine uptake too. And these are really about access. So although in a country like the UK, you wouldn't think that access to vaccination was an issue because, you know, we have lots of GP surgeries and ready access, it can be problematic for some groups. So marginalised groups, groups that aren't sort of properly in the system, recent immigrants, some ethnic minority groups, as I've mentioned, some of their reluctance or the reason they don't get vaccinated may be about accessing health services.
Well, this is interesting to consider because on the other side of this, we have healthcare workers who tend to have more or easier access to health services. And yet they've been a key group of focus for studies looking at vaccine hesitancy. So, Dr. Wolf, why is this such an important group and such a key area of concern in terms of vaccine hesitancy?
I mean, it's important generally in the population to understand why people might delay or not have a vaccine. But for healthcare workers, obviously they are at increased risk because they've got increased exposure to COVID or to the virus. But also, there is some evidence that healthcare worker attitudes towards vaccination can influence patient attitudes to vaccination. We know that healthcare workers are an important source of information for people wanting to find out about vaccines.
But I could imagine that even if vaccine hesitancy was fairly high, even among healthcare workers at the start of the vaccine rollout, particularly as this sort of one of the first groups who were receiving the vaccine, vaccine uptake now might have increased and improved. Is that the case at all?
Yeah, so I think the data show, I mean, not from UK reach, we haven't been able to look at that yet, but I believe the kind of official figures show that vaccine hesitancy is reducing. But the proportion of healthcare workers who've been vaccinated is still not probably high enough. And it's still quite low in certain groups and certain regions, I think, as well. So I was looking at the kind of government statistics from the end of May, for example, and in healthcare workers in London, only 70% had been vaccinated at that point basically the beginning of June, right, the end of May. So that's still kind of 30% who hadn't been vaccinated, which is too many in terms of what we need for coverage. So I think that, you know, at that point, probably I would guess everyone's been offered a vaccine. And so if they're not having it, it's for some other reason. So I think that hesitancy in healthcare workers is still an issue that we need to consider.
Professor Edwards, what are your thoughts? How have the attitudes of healthcare workers changed since the start of the pandemic?
During the second surge, their morale was low. I mean, they all the pressures of societal expectation and responsibility were on their shoulders, and they felt it. Without the kind of support and recognition that they didn't have the resources they felt they needed. Yes, they had people, you know, standing on their doorsteps clapping, but that didn't translate into what they wanted. So They were feeling that, you know, it would add insult to injury to try and force them or tell them that they should be getting vaccinated when, because it was really early on, yes, they were a priority group because of their work, but they were feeling like guinea pigs, and understandably. And that bit just had been missed by some of the early conversations. And healthcare workers, I mean, they're an educated bunch. You know, they can engage in these conversations. So to think that they couldn't and they should just buy this message, it's safe. You know, we've done rigorous testing, blah-de-blah-de-blah, kind of missed the point. Over time, you know, uptake has increased. There's still reluctance in some quarters. And there's a lot of current discussion over whether even identifying those quarters is tantamount to blaming those individuals, particularly since the groups that are being identified, at least in media reports, are of, you know, BAME origin or BAME heritage. It's a much more complicated picture than that.
That makes a lot of sense. And I guess those ideas could apply also more broadly to vaccine hesitancy in the general population. On that note, we're coming to the end of the first half of this podcast episode on vaccine hesitancy. We've looked so far at what vaccine hesitancy is, what it means in the context of COVID-19, what groups have been particularly hesitant towards the COVID-19 vaccine and some reasoning behind this. And finally, we've looked at healthcare workers and hesitancy in this group. In the second half of this episode, we'll be looking at what strategies and interventions can be used to try and approach vaccine hesitancy. Stay with us. Hello and welcome back to We Are STS, this episode with me, Jasmine Chakravarti, on vaccine hesitancy. In the first half of this podcast, we looked at what vaccine hesitancy is, who is hesitant and why, and we looked in particular at healthcare workers in the UK and hesitancy in that group. In this second half, we'll be looking at how we can approach vaccine hesitancy and what strategies are effective at combating this issue. One of the strategies that's often proposed for approaching or combating vaccine hesitancy is mandatory vaccination, and this is a highly contested strategy. In April, we saw Italy become the first country in Europe to introduce mandatory vaccination for health workers against COVID-19. And recently, COVID-19 vaccinations were made mandatory for care home workers in the UK, with the intention of expanding this more generally to NHS staff. So what are your thoughts on mandatory vaccination against COVID-19 and more generally as a public health strategy? Dr. Wolf.
I don't think that it is an optimal strategy when we could do other things that would increase uptake. And I think that actually increasing trust is good, not just for vaccine uptake, but is good for lots of other things as well. So I think we should really be pushing that agenda more.
Professor Edwards, what are your thoughts?
When you're in even a staunch liberal society, there comes a stage where vaccination can become mandatory and even universal if it would prevent sort of considerable harm and you've tried all the different voluntary, measures, and they've been rebuffed. In practice, quite what counts as trying all those different things and when you should think that that threshold of harm has been crossed are open questions. It's just been a shame that we've stepped rather rapidly to conversations about mandatory vaccination without fully investigating some of the interventions or conditions under which people would more voluntarily accept vaccination. I mean, we know, certain things like, once you start seeing colleagues, accepting it, you're more likely to get it. Or you feel less like a guinea pig the more time goes on and the more reports you hear from Israel saying, whoopity-doo, we're now, able to eat in restaurants again. But it's a really peculiar thing. And there are lots of interventions that theoretically you think might be acceptable, but when tested, don't seem to be. And vice versa. But what we can't do is lose more staff.
Thank you, Professor Edwards. That's a really powerful point. And in light of that, I'm wondering, how can we find a more gentle method for encouraging people to take up the vaccine? Might a targeted approach, for example, towards public health messaging be worth considering? Professor Bedford.
One of the key things, actually, that has been noted in studies about vaccine uptake is sending somebody a reminder. So sending them an invitation or a reminder is really helpful because, everybody leads busy lives and we all need reminding of these things, and that really does work. So there's lots of initiatives around there about making our services more flexible and for childhood immunisation, making them family friendly. Because if you think about taking your child along and there's nowhere proper to sit or there's no toys or it just doesn't feel very conducive, it's going to be, not such a good experience. And then, of course, having health professionals who are equipped to discuss parents' concerns with them. So, if you want to talk through things, there's somebody there who can listen to your questions and respond appropriately is really important. So it's a multifactorial thing. There isn't one factor that you can say this is going to make the difference. There's a lot of things that need to be in place to ensure we have effective vaccination services.
And what about personalized messages? So for example, I noticed in the text message I received from the NHS and from my GP that my first name was used, and I was told that I was at the top of the list. It all felt very personal, and I'm wondering if similar techniques might be useful or might already be being used in public health messaging to sort of tailor these messages and bring people in. Professor Bedford.
If you're thinking about childhood vaccination, you're much more likely to be receptive to an invitation from somebody that's known to you, like your GP or your practice nurse, and personalising it to you. So instead of saying, dear parent, dear Ms, whatever, is more likely to be effective than just an unpersonalised message. But also, I suppose, advertising campaigns are quite important too. So there was a lot of messaging at the beginning. Certainly, I'm not quite so aware of messaging now, but also thinking about that messaging. So, you might watch BBC News, but not everybody watches BBC News. So for different ethnic groups, there are, they have their own kind of media, and it's important to tap into those effectively to get the sort of message correct or the how you frame the message correct and who's providing it is important too.
Dr. Hughes, what do you think is most important when creating public health messaging campaigns? Can we rely on simply handing over the facts and the figures, making these clear to the public, or do we need to look elsewhere and bring in other techniques?
So, one, on the one hand, getting that kind of baseline bit of kind of just the key information and facts about vaccines across, it, you know, that's been handled really well, but I think it still assumes a kind of default sort of middle-class, well-educated public that will be receiving this information. And that's fine. Like, that's, to a certain extent, we need just that baseline amount of information. But it's where the effort goes into reaching communities who might be resistant, it just might not make sense to these communities. Communities who might be skeptical or mistrusting, and they're quite small. Like, you know, we don't want to make the mistake of thinking that, you know, vaccine hesitancy is like 50% of people or something. It is relatively, you know, quite a small amount of people, but it's really important because, you know, their health is on the line here, as far as the scientists and the policymakers are telling us. And I think there's really good reasons to believe that. And I think that there have been a number of drives by the government, by the NHS, by Public Health England, to try and get information to minorities, Muslim communities, other BAME communities, and to, you know, there's ads on like Instagram, on TikTok, to try and get like younger people aware of the various issues to do with COVID more generally, as well as the vaccine. And that stuff's good, but I think that for me, the things that I've seen that are most kind of interesting are coming from the bottom up. So this is things like mutual aid groups, community organizations who are working with cultural leaders in communities, say, around London, who might be working with, you know, a specific mosque in a specific community, and they will have, you know, making YouTube videos for the local community saying, you know, these are some of the concerns you might have that are specific to this group. And these are, you know, the reasons why this isn't something that you need to worry about. And the information that's happening in like WhatsApp networks for mutual aid collectives is different because it's coming from other people around you that you feel are kind of just tangible. You feel that they're in your own sphere, your own community, your own kind of, yeah, it's like your sphere of reality, because someone like Boris Johnson or Chris Whitty, they can just feel like these kind of icons that aren't real. They're just almost like celebrities. But other people that live nearby you, that, you know, you can see their phone number in your WhatsApp message, in your WhatsApp group, that are speaking the way that you speak, you know, using the same kind of diction and grammar and all of these types of things. That form of communication can be better at building relationships of trust. So I see that kind of ground up stuff as being equally as important. And it would be great to see more of that actually just resourced by the government, rather than the government trying to do all of the bottom up stuff from the top down.
And when trying to do this sort of bottom up communication and maybe make use of, or rather mirror, some of the language and the channels that are being used in many cases to spread misinformation. So in terms of language, a lot of emotive language is being used. And you mentioned WhatsApp is a key channel. How do we mirror that to propagate a message that's saying vaccines are good, they're okay? And where do we find the balance between mirroring this language and these channels and still maintaining a level of reputability and authority in order to show that, you know, it's coming, that this information is coming from a trustworthy public health institution that's scientifically backed and fact-based? Is it possible to find a balance there?
Yeah, and that's a really difficult one, because I know exactly what you're saying, is that you want that kind of scientific credibility of all of those things that I mentioned earlier, like the clinical trials and, you know, these robust forms of data and evidence gathering, which, you know, allow us to kind of rely on these studies and these published accounts of the safety and efficacy of vaccines. So we want to be able to kind of like translate that amount of certainty that we have in this, that this is really rigorous and this is good and there's good reasons for us to believe this. And you want to kind of hold on to that, because if you go down to being like, this is just my opinion. And, you know, I think that for me, that the vaccine is okay. You know, you end up losing some of the power and the weight of that kind of scientific discourse and how science builds its own credibility and how that expertise is kind of justified and legitimized. And it makes it, you know, it's difficult because if you're coming from the bottom up, you lose that. And, but at the same time, if you come from the top down, you're losing something as well. So it becomes about those kind of translations and mediations along the way. So it's about building networks of relationships between medical professionals and those support groups, you know, where you can have a kind of a mutual and kind of co-produced discussion whereby you have the authority and the credibility and all of the good things that come with that. But politically, you have an open and like a good faith conversation with groups that, because some of the times, like the really bad stuff that comes with the top-down approach is a kind of an arrogance and a closed-mindedness, is that, you know, with knowledge comes this kind of idea of certainty, and that can harden when it comes to conflict. And when, you know, scientists say all the time that the kind of the core virtue of science is that it's critical and that it's always critical of itself and it's always questioning itself. But you find quite frequently when scientists are in conflict, that kind of hardens and it becomes more like, well, no, this is reliable and this is credible and you should listen to what I have to say. So I think kind of experimenting with those kind of hybrid forms, they're sort of called, you know, where you have different forms of expertise. So the expertise of living in a given community, you know, the expertise of working with people from a specific community alongside that scientific expertise can work really well in combination to create a sort of a shared knowledge about a given topic. But again, you know, a lot of that comes from collaboration. It comes from bottom up grassroots level. And the problem usually is the fact that it's not resourced. I think that rather than, you know, the NHS trying to put money into like TikTok ads and that type of thing, which, you know, to a certain extent that's helpful. It would be great to see resources being kind of pumped into those community-led mutual aid and collaborative type projects.
Thank you, Dr. Hughes. That's a really interesting point and a really great way to finish. And thank you to all my guests, Professor Bedford, Dr. Wolf, and Professor Edwards. Those are some really great points, and I'm really excited to see what happens next and what kind of public health messaging techniques we see being used, what happens in terms of mandatory vaccinations, and also what future trends we see in terms of vaccine acceptance and vaccine uptake in the UK and elsewhere in the world. So as this episode draws to a close, I'm sitting here with my sore left arm, having recently had my vaccine. And if you recall from the start of this episode, my flatmate, who was a little bit hesitant at the very start of the vaccine rollout, has also recently had his vaccine. I'd like to thank you for joining me on this podcast about vaccine hesitancy. I hope you learned something, and I hope it gave you some insight into some of the really amazing academics that we have here at UCL who are doing some really groundbreaking research. If you are interested in finding out more about this topic, feel free to check out the links in the description below. Thank you and goodbye.
Well, that's our show for today. What a great story. And that ending. Thanks everybody for coming along today. Very special thanks to Jasmine Chakaravarti for her work on this story and for her contributions to the STS newsroom. And thanks to everybody else who lent a hand to help her out. We have more podcasts from the STS newsroom to release. This was a work experience project that paid off big for STS, and we hope to repeat it next summer. We're searching for the money right now to fund it. Music today featured two songs by Kevin MacLeod, Rollin' at 5 and Sweeter Vermouth. Both are available on the website filmmusic.io. We Are STS is a production of the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. If you're wondering about our degrees in teaching, just get in touch. We're always happy to talk. Hey, here's a thought. Maybe you want to move into science communication as a career. If that's the case, have a look at our brand new master's degree in science communication. It's a mix of practical and theoretical. We're bringing in industry professionals to keep us on the cutting edge, and we're mixing together familiar stuff in communication, like broadcasting, journalism, and publishing, with other key parts of the subject, such as communication for policy and campaigning, engagement to boost marginalized voices, and communications work in industry. We're packing a lot in, so give it a look online. We have open days coming up soon, so you can meet staff and ask your questions. That's it for today. We'll meet here again soon. Till next time, everybody, I'm Professor Joe Kane. Thanks for listening. You've been listening to We Are STS, a podcast from the Department of Science and Technology Studies at University College London. Subscribe to the show and join us online. The address, ucl.ac.uk/STS/podcast.